Oh, this is terrible. Alright. Chinese hoax.
Exactly. Right. Don't you exactly know? Not only that, but it's also perpetuated by liberals like Al Gore, who just wants to make millions off of you guys questioning whether the American economy can survive. So don't forget that also. But
there's all sorts of heroes in this discussion.
Oh, yes.
Welcome to the as of yet unnamed podcast. My name is John Anderson. I'm here in Lafayette, Colorado with Tyler in Oakland and Blake and Kelly in Denver, Colorado today. We are going to be addressing a couple things. First of all, with the new Trump regime, Heil Trump, we are going to be discussing American global leadership. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Should we be doing it? Should we not be? Where is Trump going to be taking us? So I guess we'll jump into the first segment right now. A little background, the United States basically has been the bad boy on the block of the world since 1945. We had a couple of nice advantages like the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean. Also, 50% of the world's GDP after the world was leveled in World War II. So that put us in a pretty advantageous position. So the U.S. after World War II in the 1940s, set up institutions like the UN, the IMF, the World Bank as a scaffolding to prop up a liberal global order. And this was reinforced after the fall of the wall. Isolationism is on the rise in the United States after failed interventions like Iraq and Afghanistan, we think. And also pressing needs at home. And we have that little election of Trump thing. So he seems to be moving us towards Russia, which is unique essentially in American history, and then also moving us more isolationist, which is rather unique post-World War II. Think of JFK's Bear Any Burden. So this is where we stand, and I'll open the discussion up from here. Kelly, what did I miss in terms of history? Anything you want to add?
No, I think that you covered it pretty well. I will throw a little bit more background in terms of the isolationist feelings of the United States. That has been a long-term undercurrent in both politics and the culture of the United States. And while it hasn't been as far in the surface of American politics since World War II, it certainly has always been there, and there's been a strong faction. So it's interesting to see with the election the kind of backlash against a global order and Americans' growing global footprint as a leader.
Right. I mean, George Washington warned us about this in his farewell, right? And which early president was it who said, "We will not go off in search of demons to slay, foreign demons to slay"? John Quincy, maybe? I don't know.
Quincy, that wasn't Monroe's part of the Monroe Doctrine.
No, I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
Anyways, nobody cares. So, sorry, that won't be the last time. All right,
speaking of yes. Hail Trump.
Wait, so Blake... Hail
well,
Trump.
Just in reference to what you started the podcast with. Hail Trump. Has anybody seen The Man in the High Castle, that new TV show? I'm a little fearful that we might be headed in that direction.
You want to explain The Man in the High Castle real quick?
Well, I haven't read the book, but I started watching the TV show. Basically, the United States is split in two. Half of it is ran by Germany. The other half is ran by Japan and the Nazis, of course, is Germany. And most of the civilians are under the impression that the United States lost the war. Germany and the it's
because
the
they
Nazis.
Did. They did lose the war in the
war. Right, yeah. Right.
It's a dystopic future.
I guess I haven't seen all of it. I haven't seen all of it yet. Yeah, dystopic future.
So are you afraid that we're all heading for a disaster with the Trump presidency? Is that what you're jumping in?
Who knows? It's a frightening parallel to watch on.
Tyler,
right,
how do you feel about the rise of totalitarianism in the United States? Do you see it? And in the Western world? I mean, we're talking about the liberal global order, right? And we see that possibly breaking down. We see an alternative in the rise of Putin and Russia. I mean, I know you're not exactly a big fan of United States hegemony, but like, how do we feel about this? Is it maybe a necessary evil?
Well, first I want to say I'm in Berkeley, not Oakland, but I'm just over the border, so close enough.
Wow.
You're John.
Fuck me. Is there a smug cloud around there?
There is.
Anywhere?
Yeah.
How's your Prius?
Yeah, I need to charge it. So, I mean, in terms of totalitarianism in the Western world, as we're seeing it happen, I think, I have a few points. Things that worry me are things that I notice, specifically psychologically, which is like, this othering that seems to be necessary for nation states to hold sway. It's not just nation states. There are many things that add to that, right? But because there are other nation states where individualism is not as rooted as it is in our culture. But individualism and nation states, as they go together, it really breeds the necessity of othering in order for there to build a sense of self. And so when you have a culture that's so hyper-individualized as ours is, you risk that totalitarianism because it feeds into that same psychological structure of the in-group and out-group. And, you know, if we look at collectivist cultures, it's not that there isn't in-groups and out-groups, but it's that the selfhood is more associated with group ideology. And that has its own faults, of course. But what we're seeing if we're moving towards totalitarianism, at least having some signs of it, is it's coming about through populist movements. And that's where the individualism aspect comes in, because it plays into like, what are my, you know, immediate necessities? What are the immediate necessities of the people that I interact with? And other than that, it really doesn't go much farther. It doesn't start to think about kind of, you know, the collective outside of my immediate friend group, my immediate people that I have contact with, the people that I have intimate relations with. It doesn't start to like stretch further. So in a country like the United States, where you have so many communities, and, you know, in other countries now, you know, because of, well, we can get into because of why, but the, you know, the, with all the refugees and just the natural mixing of cultures and globalization, that's a huge tension there, because these others are now becoming part of the sense of country and nation, which then becomes also the sense of self. And that's a huge difficulty when you don't have any relationship with those types of people.
I just want to cut in real quick and just explain for those who may be listening who are not familiar with totalitarianism, just read off the definition real quick. It centralized control by an autocratic authority. Definition two, the political concept that the citizen should be totally subject to an absolute state authority. So an example would be in times of crisis, when a nation's people are frightened, there are often calls for totalitarianism. Compliments of Merriam-Webster Dictionary.
All right, so this is going to derail us a little bit from American global leadership, but I think we have an interesting question here that Tyler has raised, which is, I think we can all agree Trump is an autocrat and admires autocrats and is into some form of totalitarianism as much as he can get it, and it's really interesting, and I think we can all agree that we live in a very individualistic society, and so it's really interesting that an autocrat was able to rise in a country of such individuals, especially after we had a political movement of, yes, we can, right? There's a we in there, instead of Trump saying, I can solve all your problems. And I think that's a really interesting dichotomy. And so I don't know who wants to jump on this, but like, what the hell is that? Like, what is going on there?
Okay, well, deafening silence, so I'll try. I think that the issue is something that arises through individualism and multiculturalism. Because individualism seems to work or have its benefits in like the immediate needs of oneself. That makes perfect sense. That's natural, right? But in a multicultural society, you have many different ideas of what's important to oneself. You have many different cultures that then dictate what's important to oneself. You have many different religions which dictate what's important to each individual self. And so when you then, so if you have a country that has been based in a certain ethnic group and a certain gender has the power there, so i.e. white men in our history and the history of Western countries, and then you have, and that's where the power is held. And so people's individual identity is in some way tied to that structure. Now, I'm talking about specifically those in power. So specifically those in power, their sense of self, their sense of individualism is tied to the power structure, which, you know, is in favor of white men. So then as multiculturalism becomes more and more of a reality in, you know, said country, let's say the United States, then, you know, as in any democracy, equality, you know, begins to be demanded, then the sense of self feels like it's being diminished for those who are in power, because the power is the sense of self. And that's where autocrats can come in, because they're saying like, no, there's nothing wrong with you. Like, the problem is these other people. And you're like, yeah, that's right. Because it reinforces that being in power, that this group of people being in power is what has us on the right track. And it's not always stated, obviously, not always stated that explicitly, but it's there pretty clearly, not too low below the surface. I mean, you know, like reading about Bannon today, he's like, yeah, like we're having a populist movement. He's like, I'm not a white nationalist. I'm a nationalist. I'm an economic nationalist. All right, well, what does that mean, right? If you dig a little bit deeper into if you're just a quote-unquote nationalist, what is your derivative of nationality? And if we look at historically what Western civilization's ideology of what makes one a citizen of that country, you can tell because of the color of their skin, and usually because they're men, because those are the only ones who can hold property and therefore have power. So, I mean, I don't know. Someone else jump in here. Stop me, please.
Kelly, Blake, thoughts?
John, can you restate the question that we started that whole thing with?
So the question is, yes, we have exposed that the United States has a, on the spectrum of nations that value individualism or community, we are generally viewed as a nation that is fairly on the individual side of things, right? Which seems to be pretty contradictory to the rise of a totalitarian, right? Like, why in the world would we have a federal system, a system of federalism and an autocrat? It just doesn't make any sense. And so the question very basically is, how does an autocrat rise in a country of individualists? Like, how does that happen?
He can rise, but how long will he be in power? You know, I feel that there's a certain amount of checks and balances in our system that will only enable him to do so much. So yes, he's an autocrat. Yes, he has been elected to be our next president of the United States. But, you know, there's checks and balances with that job. And, you know, this might just be a little speed bump. It might be kind of a big speed bump for us, but you know, we might also roll back a little bit and have to push down a little more gas to get over that speed bump. But you know, this could just be you know, in 4 years, just another exhale of the breath of life and politics that is.
Got it.
Well, I think elections are going to have consequences, and we're about to see some of that. So let's get back to some of those consequences on the international playing field here. So we see the United States and so let's talk about the unwinding of the Atlantic Alliance, right? So NATO, the National Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is some say the most successful military alliance in human history, and I'm sure we can get some good debate up about that. But it has held together some semblance of order in Europe for a record number of years. Now, that is really at risk because Article 5 states that an attack on one nation is an attack on all nations. That rests on the basis of deterrence. As soon as you question deterrence, you no longer have deterrence. And our next president has said that he will not defend countries that don't pay their fair share, which has pretty much undermined deterrence. And so we see, we're going to see how Putin responds to that, but we could see action, more aggressive action in the Baltics and in Ukraine and around the periphery. And so I think the question is, in terms of American leadership, like, are we okay with the necessary evil of American hegemony? Like, is that a thing? Can we agree on that? Like, how do we all feel about that? Like, here's the counterexample, is that the United States is very strong and really reinforces NATO, and Putin knows there will be severe consequences for threatening NATO, and therefore thinks more heavily about action. Like, how do we feel about that scenario?
So to kind of answer, I guess, a few of those questions that you were talking about, John, first of all, I think that with the election of Trump and the advisors that he has around him, it raises some serious questions about where exactly we go as an international power. There's no debate that the United States is an international power at this point. Will we remain one, and will we see the power that we have in international organizations decrease depending on how we act in the next 4 years? Absolutely. If Trump chooses to go down a path where our allies at NATO and the UN are not helped, we don't take strong action against either military or economic pushes by countries like Russia and China, the entire international economy and international power structure could change. And unfortunately, if you look at it now, even within the last couple weeks since the election here, there's been a backlash with Russia looking even more aggressive than they had in the past few months in places like Syria. And I think that there is very legitimate concern in the Baltic states and in parts of Eastern Europe, where Russia did have a stronghold for very many years and has not liked the fact that the U.S. has gained more influence over the economic structure and a lot of the military structure in the region. But as far as, I guess, connecting that back to U.S. global leadership, we can look at it, I think, in two ways, in terms of, one, either, like you said, John, a hegemony, or two, as a cooperative leader. And I think that's really the debate right now for some circles. And then for other circles, like in the Trump camp, it's whether or not we should pay any attention to certain foreign actions and whether we should be involved or not, which goes back to our earlier conversation about isolationism.
Right. Yeah, I think that it's really important that the United States plays a role, and a really active role. And I think one of the reasons why is because I think we are most likely to be the least worst leader of the world for a couple of reasons. Number one, I'm biased in this, but I am a fan of liberal values, turns out. I think that they are generally good for people and somewhere around universal. Although I think we can get a debate about that too. Number two is we don't have any immediate threats as far as, I mean, we feel like we do, but we don't have a neighboring state that threatens us, right? Because of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and because of Mexico and Canada, we have more flexibility in terms of doing good in the world, I think, because we have more flexibility. And so I think it is really important that we stay involved in the world. I think that is, I mean, obviously we can count many, 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 many things that we have done wrong, but I think that it could be worse. And I think that in the realm of really hard, difficult things, it could be worse is doing pretty good.
I agree, John. I think what shocks me the most about, say, Trump's foreign policy and some of the things he's proposed is he just doesn't understand some of our relationships and their importance around the world. Take, you know, our military presence in Japan or the South China Sea. You know, that's kind of an anchor and it relies or it gives some balance to that region of the world when you have this rising superpower like China, you know, and then North Korea making and launching nuclear missiles and testing those in the area. And, you know, it's important for us to have not only an economic relationship with that part of the world and to be involved there, but also to be actively and physically there with our military presence just to keep the peace. You know, yeah, I don't think he realizes the importance of that and how quickly that can change things.
I really agree with you. I think one of the things that has kept, well, I'll say I really fear that if the United States security umbrella retreats from certain countries, the result will be them making more guns. And more guns in the world in more nations, I think is just a generally bad thing. I think that just gives us more opportunity for people dying. And so I think U.S. retreat will result in that, and we need to stay active. But that I think that it is also important to say that the budget of the Defense Department or the budget of the State Department should look a lot more like the budget for the Defense Department and vice versa. And I think the United States would be would do much better and be a lot more secure if we did do that, although there is some debate about that.
Maybe we can get Trump to listen to this podcast.
There you go. I just wanted to chime in, and as John mentioned earlier, y'all know how I feel about U.S. Hegemony or imperialism, however you want to name it. but I do think, you know, it's the same way in which it's like white men fucked up the world, so we should just stop doing anything. It doesn't really work that way. You know, we find ourselves in this position, and so yeah, what are we gonna do with it? And you know, over the last few years, I've really been reconsidering my own ideas about leadership, my own feelings about it, because I think mostly we think of leadership as there's a leader and there's followers, right? But you know, there's a different form of leadership in which leaders actually train other leaders. Like, it's not that you lead everything; it's that, like, you know, you are good at certain things. The United States is good at certain things. And, you know, you lift up and, like, really, like, help tease out and support the, like, what other nations, like, what do they care about? Like, what's important to them? What are the things, what are the tasks that they can take on? What, you know, in terms of their role? And you really support that, right? So it becomes more of, like, a network, you know, and, like, more of a, you know,
yeah,
co-leading type of thing. And I think, you know, that's a very grand sweeping statement, but I think it's something we need to work towards.
You mean if, like, you have a child and he's good at soccer, you should let him play soccer and not force him to play your favorite sport, which might be basketball. You know, you want to invest in what they're good in. and let them kind of excel in that area.
Yeah, and it's also like, I don't know, I've seen it with certain individuals where you don't, you know, it's like that, you don't feel like they're your boss. You just like want them to like talk to you and like, you know, like you just want them to give you pointers, that you want them to, because they're nurturing something in you, not for the sake of themselves, but for the sake of you.
Right.
You know, and you know, like,
well,
go ahead.
Go ahead, Tyler.
No, I'm just going to say that's something that we obviously is like missing. Like there's just certain disconnects. Like when we dropped peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for people in Afghanistan, like you're not thinking about them. It's clear. It's clear you're not thinking about those human beings, because you would realize obviously they don't eat fucking peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So it's like, you know, there has to be like a psychological shift where you start looking at, okay, what do these people care about? What is their lives like? What are they, you know, and then working with other global leaders, you know, in that capacity.
So
I'm sure somebody out there would enjoy peanut butter and jelly.
we're bringing freedom to them and peanut butter and jelly. So there you go.
Parachute? Never mind.
This is a thing that a concept that exists, right? In the much derided phrase leading from behind. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's I totally agree with you, Tyler. I think that number one, in terms of like personal leadership, one of the metrics that I use to judge a leader is how many leaders that leader creates. Right. I think that is a really strong metric of a lot of different leadership skills, if you're able to do that. And in terms of nation states, I think that kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier. The United States, because of our unique position in the world, can act in a supporting role. And we, frankly, have capabilities in terms of like global logistics that no other country has.
Yeah.
And so in terms of like disaster relief, we can play a unique role that no other country can. And that is something I think that we should be really, really active and adamant about instead of isolationism.
Yeah. Mm.
And so that is the more active American leadership I'd like to see. More butter, less guns, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I will say Fidel Castro was known for supporting many, many countries, especially African countries.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see the reception. I mean, Trudeau had some positive things to say about Mr. Castro.
Yeah.
So his legacy is going to be interesting, although...
divisive figure.
Yeah.
Yeah, people are not a big fan of him in America. But what did Mr. Mott used to say? We're going to turn that whole place into Vegas as soon as Castro goes.
Yeah.
So
it's turning out to be true.
It's true.
It's happening.
Yeah. If you want to say the real Cuba, you should probably get down there soon.
Yeah, no shit, right? All right. Well, we've made it to Cuba, which is usually the ending of every discussion. So I guess we'll transition over to segment two, the Standing Rock. Tyler, I don't know if you want to give the summary. I could give the summary here, but I'll mostly be reading a PowerPoint presentation.
you can give the summary if you want, and then just kick it over to me.
All right, let me do the PowerPoint. So there is this wonderful company named Energy Transfer Partners, and they decided that they wanted to move oil from the Bakken's oil field in North Dakota, which we all know is the oil sands and is pumping out oil like nobody's business, to Illinois, I'm assuming to the refinery, although I did not double check that. And we've seen, so the Bakken oil fields have blown up in the last couple of years, and one of the things is there was not the distribution, I guess is the term, capacity for oil, so they've been trying to build pipelines, and that's been part of the Keystone pipeline as well, I believe, as well as they've been transporting using rail, and that's been super dangerous too. You've probably seen in the news lots of like this train derailed and blew up. Probably came from the Bakken oil field. So they are putting in this pipeline, and it goes just north of the Standing Rock Indian Reservation and crosses their main water source. So that's a problem because oil is not good to drink. So if there's a spill, we're really concerned about that. Additionally, it goes through some newly discovered sacred burial grounds, which is also a problem. So currently there is a Occupy-like camp at the site of the dig that is preventing the dig. There's been a court battle. It is the case is winding its way through the courts. There was a DC court that denied the injunction, and then the Obama administration stepped in, and it's still winding its way through the courts. And the Army Corps of Engineers said that they will be looking at alternative routes, so we're really up in the air. We're especially up in the air because of the election of our Grand Fuhrer. So, because the CEO of Energy Transfer Partners, who I'm sure is a wonderful person, donated $100,000 to the Trump campaign, and they said that they expect him to approve the pipeline in January. There has been multiple incidents of violence. In one incident in cold weather, the authorities blasted people with water cannons, sending I think a couple dozen people to the hospital with hypothermia and broken bones.
I believe some of the temperatures when that happened too were below freezing.
So there you go. There's been, that is just one example of many other acts of violence. And so we want to, this is our segment that we're going to end every podcast with. It is the action segment. We are not here to talk. We're here to do things. So we're going to go through how best we can all get involved in this. So first, Tyler, I think you've been paying most attention to this issue. Did I get everything right? What do you want to add? Take it away.
Very great synopsis. I think what we need to highlight is what's really important is that this is an indigenous peoples movement. And we really need to center that. Obviously, there are ecological issues that affect us all. But this, violence, militarized violence of the state versus indigenous peoples has been going on since the beginning of our country, since people first started colonizing this land.
Before 1492, sailed the oceans blue with a bunch of fucking smallpox.
Yeah. Columbus enslaved and murdered like most of the indigenous people of Haiti. Been going on for our entire history. And so, this is nothing new for indigenous peoples. It's something new in the last so many years that something like this has become so high profile. Probably since the second massacre of Wounded Knee in the 70s. And so it's really important to highlight that for many reasons. One, to really acknowledge that leadership there, and also that they're the ones being most directly threatened, although, of course, the oil spill could hurt others as well.
I'm sorry, can I inject real quick? Yeah. Acknowledge the leadership of the indigenous peoples.
Correct.
In this situation?
Sorry. So, okay. Yeah, it's really important to, acknowledge the leadership of the indigenous peoples. Because there's a lot of high-profile actors and, politicians or whatever who are speaking up about this. But, let it be known that it was the people of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation who began this protest. It began small. I'm not sure if the burial ground was newly discovered or not. I don't know about that, but I believe it was one woman who knew that the burial ground of some of her actual ancestors was being disrupted, was being just devastated and so desecrated, excuse me. And so her and a few people were the ones who physically went there to start, right? And people putting their bodies on the line is really important, right? You're risking, as John mentioned, a lot of physical violence at the hands of the state. And so I think we really need to center that, not only because they began it, not only because this is the largest, meeting of different various tribes in, the history of this country since 1776. I don't think there's been a larger gathering of different tribes. United for one purpose.
You mean in terms of like different tribes or different people?
No, very
like the number of tribes or number of people?
Number of tribes.
I think as far as protest goes, I think you're right.
Yeah. And also around this, which is so essential, right, is that, you know, not only, you know, is colonization a physical thing, it's also obviously a psychological thing, right? You hear the term decolonize the mind. And that's important because in this situation, you know, colonization has a certain psychology behind it. And one of those is like land and resources or yours for the taking, right? And so what's being presented here to a mainstream colonizing society is that, you know, water is life, right? And these are not resources that we just can take at our whim, right? It's really being like, this is us. These are the building blocks of our life. And when you threaten that, you threaten us. And it's not a metaphor. It's not a nicety. It's not like a nice turn of phrase. It's like an actual lived reality for these people. And this is how they lived for thousands of years before, you know, us colonizers came. And I think that's really important to acknowledge, that it's not just about ecology. It's not just about, you know, these movements, but it's also like a very real cultural difference.
So Tyler, I want to come back to you on some things, but first, I was really struck by water of life, or life is
water.
What did you say about water?
Water is life.
Water is life. Water is life. So, Kelly, as our resident environmental historian, do you think we're seeing a preview of how climate change could affect our lives going forward into this? Could this be I don't want to say a dress rehearsal, but that something around that as a metaphor?
I'm quick to jump this into the environmental issue, though I think that long-term climate change, man-made global warming is obviously an important issue to discuss. I think what's important here to note about the pipelines in general is that explosions and leakages have actually been far more minimal than is usually considered to be true, especially on a lot of more liberal-leaning discussions. While it's not okay to misuse a land that has been perpetually worshipped by a group of people and have ancestors buried in it, the evidence that there would be some kind of horrible environmental disaster there is pretty low. And I think that's an important thing to note during the conversation, though it shouldn't be a factor that stops somebody from arguing against having something like that in their backyard. I think everybody has the right to say that, whether or not the energy needs of the United States is greater than that. Secondly, is it a dress rehearsal for long-term environmental catastrophes and ways to protest against the government? Potentially. You know, we're looking at a administration that openly doesn't believe in the science of climate change and global warming.
No, dude, it was the Chinese. It's a Chinese hoax.
Exactly. Right.
Don't you
exactly
know?
Not only that, but it's also perpetuated by liberals like Al Gore, who just wants to make millions off of you guys questioning whether the American economy can survive. Don't forget that also. But
there's all sorts of heroes in this discussion.
Oh yes. But I think it is important as we go forward that we can potentially take some lessons from these once the action is done, and whether or not the protesters are successful or not in stopping this, then we can kind of analyze how this could be used in the future to help combat certain climate actions. But I think it's probably more important here to talk about what we can do to help the protesters.
So Tyler, you said acknowledge leadership, right? And I asked you about that. What does that look like? Like, I am an ignorant white male of Irish descent. And so, like, what do I personally do to acknowledge their leadership? Like, what actions am I taking? What am I doing to do that? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I would say, there's so many ways. I'm not going to put one above the other. I'm just going to start saying things. So follow them on social media, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, Sacred Stone Camp, Medical and Healers of Sacred Stone Camp, I believe, is the name of the medical one. Yeah,
we'll throw all these in the show notes.
Yeah, those are all in the show notes to go below. Really important, you know, follow them on Facebook. I believe they have Twitters as well. Although I'm not a tweeter myself. And so that's the place, because those are the people who are leading the movement. And so they post, I mean, you know, they're the central ones. So they will post what they think are the best links, articles.
And then just literally follow them.
Yeah. And literally like follow their lead. You know, we live in an amazing time where we can really touch in with these things happening at a large distance. You know, then there's many ways. Obviously, donating money is huge. If you have access to resources, like pass on those resources. And
I would just like to note, we're going to compile some organizations or perhaps some other institutions that you can direct that those donations towards. We're going to put that up on our blog after this podcast. So.
Beautiful, thank you, Blake. There's places we'll give you those resources. Also now, the month of December, so this is really timely. The month of December has been called, as, a month of action, for the No DAPL, No Dakota Access Pipeline, which is the hashtag. And the reason for that, I mean, there are many reasons, one that it's cold and it's getting drastic for the people out there, but also because January 1st, this is very important. January 1st, is the deadline in the contract that the Energy Partners?
The Energy Transfer
Energy
Partners.
Transfer Partners.
Super innocuous bullshit name.
Yeah. So Energy Transfer Partners contract with all of their funders. In that contract, the deadline for completion of the pipeline is January 1st. So if the pipeline is not complete by then, that means that they have not fulfilled their contract, which means that all the investors are no longer legally bound to that contract or to pay them. So basically, anybody who doesn't want to anymore, they've already lost billions of dollars on this, I believe. And so it's already really financially really been, you know, terrible for them, which is exactly what we want because money speaks. And so
that deadline's January 1st.
That deadline is January 1st. So the other thing about that is before Trump takes office. So December is a crucial time for really putting pressure on all these organizations. We'll put some more resources also to links where you can find actions happening. Go out there, be part of those actions. There's a lot of actions on banks. I personally am doing something I should have done a long time ago, but in solidarity, doing it now is shutting down my Bank of America account because they are huge funders.
Evergreen National Bank, baby.
Exactly. Move your money to local banks or credit unions. And so these are the types of actions. Now, you know, whether or not to go to Standing Rock, that was a thing for a while. There was a call for just lots of people to come. There's been a little bit of pushback. I've seen some things about white people treating it like Burning Man, and kind of inexperienced people, like inexperienced activists coming there. And like, you know, activism is like, you have to be trained in it. You know, it's not just something you just show up and do, because we have reactions. Like when someone sprays you with a fucking water cannon, like you want to like go punch that person in the face. That is a natural human response. So you have to learn to train to like really be nonviolent. So they don't just want like fucking, I've seen it on people on who I, you know, who are, you know, leaders in this movement kind of speak on both ends of it. But I would just like follow that and kind of see, are they calling for more people? Right now, they're really only calling for specific people like medics and lawyers. But so that's another aspect. If you want to get more involved, like with, you know, physically, look to actions at home, closer to home.
All right. Well, Tyler, thank you. Blake? Kelly, do you have anything more to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I've come up with some ideas. I don't want to scare anybody away from this podcast, so I might save them until further experimentation.
We'll throw them up on the blog.
Let's just say I think I'm going to take a drive up to the mountains this weekend. I'm going to bring my didgeridoo and my camera, and I'm looking for buffalo.
So all right.
I'll feel you guys in next week.
Yeah, I would say the last thing that I would suggest on top of everything we've talked about is to continue to educate yourself and to educate those around you on these issues we've been talking about, and especially the ones around land rights and Native Americans' issues surrounding proper use of their land. I think it's very important, and as part of the blog, we'll enter some books and some further readings to help you guys continue to read on and educate yourself on the topics.
Fight the good fight.
And please also, if you're so inclined, whatever way you pray or you offer your thoughts, those things have an effect too. You'll probably hear me in this podcast bringing up these types of things, but I think it's an important thing for the shift of our culture to connect in other ways with these issues and with the actions that are happening on the ground. So yeah, if you're someone who prays, if you're someone who likes to contemplate or meditate, you know, send that energy their direction. You know, the water protectors need all the support they can get.
Do whatever you can, right?
Whatever you can.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for what is going to be many great podcasts, I'm sure. And we'll be back next week.
Yeah.
Bye.